Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this.
And we are a go.
We're actually recording.
We are actually recording. So you can do all those stupid jokes you wanted to do now, and they'll be...
I will do none of them.
They'll be immortalized.
All right, perhaps you should tell our audience about our distinguished guest today, Charlie.
A scholar of the bod and
of the bod. Sex therapist, Shannon Dobronsky.
So, hey, Shannon. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, Charlie. I'm happy to be here.
You'll regret this in about 5 minutes.
I don't doubt it.
Shannon has been on the air with me before. Have you
oh,
ever
really?
Been on Inside the Black Box? That's not exactly your wheelhouse.
No. Inside the Black Box, is that improv? What's Inside the Black Box?
Ooh, nicely
usually,
done.
Usually it is improv, actually.
It's Pete's show about science, but only funnier. It's they try and demystify a lot of the
science
processes.
And technology for normal people.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cool.
But so you've been on Lost in the Stacks?
You're popping.
Yes.
You're popping, you motherfucker. Drop that microphone down a little bit.
Already. That didn't take long at all for both the popping
surly.
And the profanity.
Exactly. You're very surly for a father to be. You think you'd be a little more
I'm exactly as surly as a father to be.
He is warming up.
That's right. And also, I threw out a motherfucker because that is the one curse word that only appears once in Deadwood.
No, seriously?
That is the reference? How many times it appears in Deadwood?
Motherfucker was anachronistic, and so they let his name just leapt out of my head.
Swearingen.
No, it wasn't him. It was the guy who was in, Blade Runner.
He was in Blade Runner.
Who was the innkeeper, the original slimy innkeeper?
I loved him. Yeah, he was in Blade Runner.
Yeah.
I forgot that was
Sebastian.
He was also Larry and my other brother, Larry?
Oh, the guy that played the robotics designer.
That's the one.
I love that movie.
What was his name?
Larry. I don't know the actor's name.
Larry.
But he's very good at Blade Runner.
Newhart.
It'll come
anyway,
to me later.
He has a speech when he's cleaning the bloodstain off the floor of after the original killing, right? And he's cleaning the bloodstain and he's talking about Swearingen and he calls him a motherfucker at the end of that speech. And in the commentary that I was listening to, because I was obsessively watching and listening to DVD commentaries of Deadwood, they say, yeah, we just let him get away with that. It's not really, that's one of the words that we weren't going to use. So
he was improvising? That wasn't scripted?
He might have improvised it, or it might have been written, and then the person who was getting away with it might have been the writer, or I don't know. But I just remember it was that one of those Milch sort of, you know, yes, I'm clean and sober, but I sound like I've been on a bender kind of commentaries where he's just sort of... Okay, so let's explain...
Well, that's an interesting segue, actually, because our guest today, who has a PhD in, is it English literature?
Yes, it is.
Who did study Shakespeare, the bard,
there's
not the
bod. There's the tiniest bit of sadness when you said that, but yes, it is.
Yeah, what's wrong? There's no shame in that. What's wrong?
Oh,
with
no,
that?
There's no shame. There's no shame. I have a degree in English literature and something that elevates the human spirit. So, no, I'm proud of my degree.
But aren't you a fascinating person at cocktail parties? Because I got to tell you, a guy with a PhD in chemical engineering is not.
Yeah, well, I mean, really, that's why they constructed the PhD, to make people more fascinating at cocktail parties.
I should
there's
just
your purpose
stamp
for higher
that
education.
On my forehead. Why'd you get a PhD? To be more fascinating in cocktail parties.
So how did you get to tech? I mean, let me bury the lead, that Deadwood lead. How'd you get to tech on an English literature PhD?
So I was at the University of Texas working on my dissertation, and I was dating this fellow who was finishing his dissertation, and we were both on the job market at the same time. And our field was English literature, and specifically literature of the English Renaissance. And we applied for many, many of the same jobs, and I'd say to the credit—
You all were fighting it out a little bit on the job market?
We were concerned that we would be fighting it out on the job market, but it turns out that there's legitimacy to the job search process because we did not have any of the same interviews. So we were, you know, unique enough, despite our fairly similar background in our self-presentation, that we each had a number of interviews, and none of them overlapped.
Would you say that was your strengths, separate from the degree, or what got you into different job interviews? Or?
The truth is, he was more interested in poetry, and he was more interested in the work of John Milton, and I was clearly Shakespeare, Shakespeare, Shakespeare. So the people who wanted sort of 17th century poetry didn't also want Shakespeare, and thus we didn't overlap that
much.
Would
that be the Milton from my favorite movie, Animal
House?
That's true.
That's exactly right.
I don't know the reference.
Donald Sutherland is kind of harsh on Milton. But then finishes with,
teaching an English class.
You have to learn this. I'm not joking. This is my job.
Yeah, so whenever the students just aren't listening to you at all, he's like, I'm not joking. This is my job.
What are the criticisms
he said,
of Milton in Animal House?
Don't write this down, but I find Milton as boring as you find Milton.
The jokes are atrocious?
Yeah, was the jokes don't translate well to this generation. Yeah. Mrs. Milton probably found him boring, too. I don't see how we can make that claim. It's not like he knew anything about his spouse.
Is
there a lot written about Milton's spouse?
There is. Holy cow. Milton has a bad reputation for not being especially kind to women, and that includes spouse and daughters. But that's unfair, and I need to emphasize that's unfair lest I provoke trouble at home. That's a completely unfair characterization. But Donald Sutherland in Animal House is not the first to criticize Milton. Samuel Johnson said of Paradise Lost, and I'm going to butcher this, so I hope nobody
No one can quote Samuel Johnson correctly. So.
Yeah, well, it's something like nobody ever wished it longer. Something in that vein. So
is that about his
Donald
writing or a
company.
Dirty joke? I'm not really sure.
Well done.
Yes.
So you were looking for jobs.
We were looking for jobs, and my husband, we married in the end, got a job at
Spoiler
Georgia
alert.
State, and they were hiring.
You mean the Bull Bransky?
The Bull Bransky?
Dobransky the Bull. Now that we've done the Dobransky,
isn't that a children's book?
Got in there. I just think of
Ferdinand
you all as a family
Bull,
of linebackers now.
Because this is just what we're like.
The Branskys.
We're hardy.
He played for Green Bay back in the 70s.
Yeah. So, and the English lit thing, that's just the backup career.
I am totally going to track down linebackers who have English degrees. That's what I want. Yeah. Okay, so who found the job?
He got the job. He got the job at Georgia State, and they were hiring Britain fellows here at Georgia Tech. These are postdoctoral teaching fellowships for people who want to teach composition in the Atlanta area after they've finished their PhD. I had not, in fact, finished mine, but I got the gig anyway.
You get to write the book wherever you go.
But occasionally we do hire Britain fellows that are in the process of finishing their PhD.
Yeah, that used to be true more than it is now. So I came in before they were strict on the postdoctoral.
So how long ago was that?
18 years.
Wow. You have thrived. Did you go away and come back, or did you get the Britain Fellow job and then just like turn it into a rather successful career?
I have been here my entire adult life. So, yeah, no, I did turn it into a successful career. I've been at Georgia Tech for 18 years, the entire 18 years. And I spent 5 of those just as an instructor, and then I moved into a coordinator position in what anywhere else would be the English department, and here's literature, media, and communication.
And weren't you involved in computational media for a while?
Yes, that's true. I had the opportunity to coordinate the joint degree between College of Computing and Literature, Media, and Communication, computational media.
And now you're the director of the Center for Academic Success.
You are both directors of centers.
That and $10 will get you a latte at Starbucks.
I think it's 15 now.
But I will say this, as the nerdy guy, so this show is about the intersection of science and humanities.
Yeah, Pete's the nerdy guy.
Oh, well.
Well, as the techno-nerdy guy, you guys would be the humanities nerdy people.
Notice that Pete has the stylish facial hair.
It's true.
And the good haircut.
It's true. It's a look.
It's the number 2 attachment on the wall,
Everyone
you
should,
go by it's haircut by the numbers.
Everyone
number
should
one,
know
number
I have not shaved or cut my hair since I don't remember when.
Actually, I think this is the number one.
End of September.
I think it's
end
the number
September
one.
End of September was the last time I had a haircut.
You are very tidy.
You have twins on the way, so you're allowed to just wallow in your own crapulence. But
no kidding. He's very tidy. You wouldn't guess that he was unshorn since September. It's okay.
The gray disguises a lot of the.
consilience where we use words like unshorn.
I told you she was going to elevate this piece of shit.
And no, and she has. I learned about Milton. I didn't know that about Milton. That was very impressive.
So from now you're going to make wife beater jokes instead of the this is my job joke?
He didn't beat anybody. He did. He was a proponent of divorce before that was a thing to do. So, oh,
he didn't. He did not dig divorce.
No, he did.
Oh, he did dig. Oh,
not
he
an
what?
Opponent, a proponent.
Got it. Got it.
So no, yeah.
But because I'm listening
because
to the audiobook,
of Mrs. Milton.
Well, he believed that you know you should be compatible with your spouse.
That's
crazy.
A very
was willing, was
idea.
He willing? Well, I think that's nice. But was he willing to meet her halfway? I know that's a requirement of my wife. Do what I say.
Yeah, there was an unfortunate early marriage, and I'm not the expert. We'd have to bring Stephen in here to talk about it in more detail. But
next week on Consilience,
divorce.
He was not interested in compromising his domestic happiness.
But the point I want to make, and maybe it's because I'm reading or I'm listening to the audiobook of Is College Worth It by William Bennett. I didn't realize it was the same William Bennett until
yeah,
Charlie
Pete and
pointed
I, before
out to
the
me.
Mics went on, we had a discussion of who Bill Bennett was. He was, of course, a man who wrote The Book of Virtues, which was an unironic title, at the same time that it became clear that he was a gambling addict.
Also, went to the University of Texas. Hook 'em. And Texas lore has it that he was there at the same time as Janis Joplin and that they were set up on a blind date.
That's awesome.
Isn't it?
What's the hook 'em part? Did I miss that?
Hook 'em horns.
Okay, so there's a hand gesture that goes with it.
I know the gesture.
Yeah, so it's your pinky and your index finger up.
For
and
the longhorns.
Your thumb wrapped around the other two fingers to create the
little bull
horns. Yeah, so and then you say hook 'em.
That just makes sure people know that it's live.
Uh-huh.
I'm actually headed to Austin, Texas in 2 days.
For my people, everyone should know that Shannon just threw the horns of rock. That's what she was doing.
No, I think the horns of rock, you don't do this, the middle part, like a bowl.
If you've broken your hand on someone's face, you have to do it like that.
I didn't stick my tongue out, so.
I guess that is an important part of it. No, but the point I'm trying to make is,
as the nerdy guy.
Well, yeah, and now I'm thinking about parents and valuing college education. I still think, even halfway into this book, that Georgia Tech is one of the best values in college education. But we're not as nerdy as you think. So, for example, you were a Britton Fellow. Some really amazingly talented people that I work with here at Georgia Tech, in addition to yourself, were Britton Fellows. The Britton Fellow program is excellent. The Britton Fellows come in, and you will teach our English 1101, 1102, and other courses. But you have some autonomy to bring your own research, your own flavor, your own passion to it. And the courses that students can choose from vary from, obviously, say, Shakespeare to the humor in prose, cinema, horror movies, just amazing diversity.
Yeah, there's a Britton Fellow who did a zombies class. There's a Britton Fellow who did a meat and potatoes class, and that was the textual studies of cattle. And potato farming in England. Yeah.
We've had a surprising number of actually cow classes. So, it's true. We've had cows in romanticism. We've had cows on the plate. We've had cows on...
All creatures, great and small. Or really big, if that's what you want to study.
Oh, sure.
But yeah, we've had folks that went on to... One of them, is it Pete Robaugh?
Pete Robaugh.
Right, who actually helps run our Project One program, coordinated our...
With Nirmal Trivedi, who was his office mate.
And that's also a Britton Fellow.
Tech versus Zombies.
Happened, yeah.
Nirmal's a Britton Fellow, so is Pete. So Wendy Neustetter, who I work with on...
She was not a Britton Fellow.
She was a Britton Fellow, yeah. Engineering education, she's a linguist. So the Britton Fellow program here at Georgia Tech is on the humanities side, but even as a technical person, it's something I brag about to parents and prospective students. I think it's a great program.
Yeah, fun fact, Eugene Thacker, who wrote In the Dust of This Planet, was a Britton Fellow.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No, he was not.
No, he was tenure track faculty.
I did. I actually transposed Lisa Yazyk and Eugene Thacker.
But Lisa was a Britton Fellow. It's true. Lisa also incredibly cool.
I don't know how that happened. I
who
think
studies
the science fiction thing.
Yeah, the prose of science fiction.
Yeah. Sorry, Eugene, didn't mean to demote you briefly.
He would be in excellent company, even so.
He was awesome. He gave a Merzbow box set to WREK, which is 50 CDs of noise, and they ended up playing that straight one weekend.
What kind of noise?
Really cool noise.
Okay. Because noise can be characterized mathematically, technically. It's...
Different show.
Okay.
Okay. But before we leave Eugene, I was fortunate to spend 4 weeks with Eugene and his beautiful wife in Italy on a study abroad program and enjoyed his company. And they're both fascinating people. His wife is an artist. And one day I was walking somewhere and somebody else in the program said, "Have you noticed that everybody keeps taking pictures of Eugene and his beautiful wife?" And I said, "No." And they said, "Yeah, I think people are mistaking them for supermodels." And I realized suddenly, oh my gosh, these are the most beautiful people I have personally known in my entire life.
Were you being polite or was she really beautiful?
No, they were both
really
beautiful.
And is Eugene very beautiful?
You know, I never noticed it because he's brilliant. He's, you know, because mostly you just would encounter him and go, "I'm not 100% certain what you're talking about, but I can tell it's really smart." And so that's what I always confronted when I spent time with him. But then when somebody pointed it out to me, I recognized, oh, yeah, no, they're really stunning couple.
It would be nice to be beautiful. I wonder what that's like. I'm going to go as beautiful next Halloween.
Just try to remember what it was like when you were 16. You were beautiful when you were 16.
It's no, true. I was not.
Yeah, you were. It's kind of unavoidable.
16-year-olds don't recognize their own beauty because they're surrounded by other 16-year-olds and everything is relative. Okay. But yeah, you were. We all were.
For sure.
So you have to wait till you begin to decay to understand the beauty of a 16.
I truly.
No, not all 16-year-olds are beautiful. I don't believe that.
I don't know, man. I mean,
I think all 16-year-old women are beautiful. I don't think there's any escaping it.
All right. We'll leave that for another show.
I don't know how we can continue after that. That was the pinnacle of that podcast.
No, but
right
your
there.
Original Deadwood reference really is a segue in today's topic, which is Shannon and I were having a conversation a week or two ago, and I was surprised to hear that a student of the Bard would claim that modern television is what theater was 100 years ago or something.
I don't know if I can recapture it, but it was something like... American television is to the turn of the 21st century what English theater was to the turn of the 17th century.
Okay, that sounds good. Let's go with that.
So, and what I mean by that is that I think that, you know, the English Renaissance wasn't great in the visual arts, that Italy had them all over them for visual arts, but where they really made their claim was on the stage, which was new, and it was a new way to make money, and it wasn't just Shakespeare. They had all kinds of amazing playwrights, all flourishing right at the same cultural mm-hmm. moment. And I think we're doing the same thing with television in America in the beginning of the 21st century. And, you know, I think when I started saying that about 10 years ago, it was something sort of fresh and interesting.
Right,
and
right.
Now everybody knows that, yeah, we're in a beautiful and glorious age of television.
It's because television is a reflection of society and that people enjoy watching it. Was that true of theater back then? Did people enjoy theater?
Yes. Theater was popular.
Okay.
And it was massively popular. It was across the masses popular.
Yeah, it wasn't just the rich folks that liked it.
So the Globe Theater was about the same scale as the Georgia Dome would be for Atlanta. So you could fit in the same sort of percentage of the population.
Of the population, yeah.
Yeah. So it was massively popular, and it was cheap. You know, you could go to the theater for what it would cost you to buy a pint of ale.
Wow.
Pint of beer. Whatever.
So when you started thinking this, and you said 10 years ago, so 2004, so The Wire was happening, and people hadn't quite gotten onto it, but it was starting to be a thing. Sopranos had happened. Mm-hmm. Oz had happened. Were there any other things that were sort of what was making you think, television is starting to become something different and important in a different way?
Yeah, so, I mean, it was the Sopranos were big, right?
Yeah.
And I remember driving over to our friend's house who had HBO so that we could watch Sopranos every week.
That's how we watched HBO before internet.
Yeah, that's right.
More than a pint of ale, that HBO. I'm a big fan, but it is more than a pint of ale.
It is, and thus we would drive to our friend's house. I mean, Sopranos were a big part of it, but... I mean, that wasn't all. There was also, in the late 90s, you saw things like, Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, Buffy the Vampire Slayer sounds like total schlock, and that's what I assumed it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was other Britain fellows who said, no, you got to understand, it sounds like it's for teenagers, but it's really for people in their 30s, and you'll get all the references. And
it's like The Muppet Show.
it's just like The Muppet Show.
That's the analogy I would use.
Right. And then all the Muppets turn to dust.
Whenever I think of The Muppet Show, I think about how these adults were just really enjoying themselves in an incredibly childish way. But if you go back and listen to some of the jokes, Muppet Show is so complicated.
There's two levels of the jokes.
There's three. Because there's the you're making a puppet talk, you know, which just delights a child.
For the record, Charlie was like moving his hand up and down. Like,
puppets. You're making puppets talk.
Okay, he's about to fall out of his chair.
Yeah, he's doing the
very mimicking
and so that's just
seizure.
Delightful. Felt things dancing.
It's very
Gonzo's
I could tell you like felt up against your skin. I can
again with the bod. And then in the middle ground, there's that sort of, hey, the chicken's talking, and I think Gonzo's her boyfriend, and Fozzie Bear's making stupid jokes, and Kermit, yay! Like that's sort of grade school and even adolescent, right? And then there's that other level. Like the Muppet Show actually engaged death, you know, and existential dread, like with the Phantom of the Opera episode, with some of those skits where things are eaten, you know? They did I've Got You Under My Skin, which was this slow, seductive consumption of the Muppet that he was singing it to. Which was just weird if you were a kid, but I look back and I was like, that was some creepy David Lynch stuff. Like, you know, so
I need to go back and watch it again.
Work here is done.
Yeah. You know what I loved about the Muppets was the Muppet critics.
Yes.
The Muppet critics were the cranky old guys.
Oh, the cranky old guys in Valkyrie.
The curmudgeons from the Valkyrie.
Yeah, they were good. Yeah, I think a lot of adults like that. But I think it started even before then. I mean, if I look back to the 60s and early 70s, everything was a 30-minute episode that had no, you know, connection to the following one. You know, the Dick Van Dyke Show. It was all compartmentalized. Then for a little while, and these were the predecessors of a lot of the shows you just mentioned, there were a couple of shows, St. Elsewhere and Hill Street Blues, that were serials. They actually connected from one thing to the other. You got character development, things like that. And it was the beginning. It was our first attempt at them, and so they weren't nearly as sophisticated as some of the programs you mentioned. But
Barney Miller.
I loved Barney Miller.
I feel like
Barney Miller was the classic sitcom, but Barney Miller tackled issues
and it
that were amazing.
A world that existed. Like the station room of Barney Miller was where the world came to be discussed, as opposed just like All in the Family, you know, as opposed to sitcoms where the world that you were living in was inside
the family. Very unique, but very deep, sophisticated characters, however prejudiced they might be in All in the Family. They were realistic.
Yeah.
And my favorite thing about Barney Miller was there was the nerdy guy who would always explain
Dietrich.
Things. Yeah, it was Dietrich, right. So Dietrich, he was explaining a philosophy of death. And then there was the Asian guy. I mean, I don't remember anyone. I just remember the nerd guy, the Asian guy. And he said, Asians have a very philosophical approach to death. They welcome it. They accept it. They yearn to understand it. And then the Asian guy goes, I don't know about you, but I'm going kicking and screaming all the way. It was just so. And then there was the crazy guy who was from the future. And he claimed he was from the future. And they put him in the holding cell there. And they go, well, tell us about things from the future. And someone asked them about homosexuality. And he said, actually, in the future, homosexuality is lauded as a very effective form of birth control. Who wrote that line? That just blew my mind.
They were very forward thinking. I mean, they would treat homosexuality even in more serious ways. Yeah. And I remember too, there's one where somebody brings them in some marijuana brownies, and they all get completely stoned.
I think I remember that one. Yeah.
It was a smart and thoughtful show.
And that was right after we had Laura and Rob Petrie sleeping in separate beds.
Yeah.
I mean, so that was bold for television back then.
Now, it's important for us to kind of circle back around to, in particular, why you're here, Shannon. What was different, do you think? Because if we're talking about all this TV that was vital, that was, you know, culturally interested, that was important, what was different about the time that you were saying, wait, this is starting to be more like what I studied?
So a couple of things, I think, made the difference. One is that I think that TV creators started following a little bit more in the tradition that Pete was just talking about with Seen Elsewhere and Hill Street Blues. But they started understanding that, no, we have a whole scope here. You know, we've got the opportunity for epic storytelling, you know,
world building and world
beyond
exploring.
Uncle Milty and slapstick, which was good, but that's really what it was,
kind of ejecting any leftover vaudevillian conceits.
Well, I mean, Sure. And but I think mostly embracing the notion that we don't have to work in, you know, a 47-minute format. We actually have, you know, 22 episodes in a season.
Right.
And let's start thinking in, you know, four-episode arcs or six-episode arcs or multi-season arcs.
And trusting people to follow that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that was a big difference. I think, too, that HBO made a big difference because they illustrated that you can trust your audience, okay, and that your audience will hang in there with you for a while you build suspense or create tension.
While at the same time, they were, I think, using sort of the classic exploitative tricks of real strippers, real sex on HBO, and reality shows about strippers.
Well,
and
I want to talk about reality shows shortly. I think that's a genre we cannot skip.
Okay. Hang fire on that.
Okay.
HBO was pornographic in a way at the same time that it was doing, what are we going to call this TV renaissance? Is that TV renaissance? Or
yeah, go for it. TV renaissance.
So at the same time this TV renaissance was happening, HBO was also like, and here's just a ton of tits. And eventually they brought all that together.
I don't think,
you know,
pornography
to Game of
Thrones was their goal. I mean, have you been to the Galleria Uffizi in Florence?
I have.
Yeah,
there's
and
lots
it's
of
just
boobs.
The same.
Botticelli's all over the place. No, but I'm trying to think. Was it real strippers?
I think it's real sex.
It was G-String Divas.
Yeah, G-String Divas.
Get it together.
No, G-String Divas was a gritty portrayal of life in the adult dancing, exotic dancing industry. Yeah, they showed, there was a little titillation there with women at work, but I think a lot of it was behind the scenes. It actually was a very depressing show, if you watch
as
it.
As well it should be.
Yeah.
No, but then they had one on sex workers out of Nevada, the Bunny Ranch one, and then they had Real Sex. Real Sex was just the Kinsey and Masters and Johnson folks. It was the modern version of
Pete,
that.
Pete, I feel like we've found a rich vein of your history here.
No, but Real Sex just, you know, they got rid of the constraints and they said, let's talk about real people and real sex. I don't think they were trying to be pornographic. I think they were trying to share people's views about these things.
Well, I think they were getting it both ways a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Bit,
okay.
So,
all right. I'm sure the guys, look, could you show a little of that because it sweeps weeks.
And also we're allowed to, so go ahead. So did you start thinking, Shannon, did you start thinking in research terms at this point, or were you just sort of observing and enjoying? Because you are an academic, and eventually this had to have brushed up against sort of the way that you construct the research question.
He likes to use that
phrase,
brushed up. No, you like to say rubbed up against.
I do.
You talk about pornographic. Give me a break here.
This is the dirtiest this podcast, I think, has been, except that time when you were talking about licking the microphone.
I am so proud. I am so pleased
well
to be
done.
Here.
She'll
for
wear
this.
That you, as a badge of honor.
You are a game day player.
Okay, then. So I need to qualify all my remarks by saying that I've done no research. This is all just Shannon's enthusiasm. So I've got nothing in terms of real legitimacy.
Now, why do you say that, though? Why do you say you've done no research? What are you distinguishing between? Because your enthusiasms are based on your academic interests. You know what I mean? Like to say I've done no research is almost, is you're trying to push away. I have no
expertise.
Well, she drove to her friend's house to watch HBO. That is research in my book.
Except you did all this research on English literature in particular. What was your actual?
My field was Shakespeare.
Yeah. So, you know, we're going to say you did research into Shakespeare, some serious research into Shakespeare. So then to say that by noticing connections to popular culture that you haven't done research, you certainly have, haven't you? What is missing? And this is a good version of the question I was going for. What's missing from your thinking about TV that would be the research?
Well, I haven't read all the other expert opinions on TV.
All you need to do? I mean, because I've noticed that most of the opinions about TV are people on the internet saying that they liked it.
There's a scholarly body related to television and media studies.
What
too.
Would be the canonical journal associated with that? Is there a journal on that?
I'm sure there's a journal.
There's
on
a
that.
Journal on everything. I'm learning,
like cable stations.
Well, there's a journal on, housing. on college campuses, now that I'm spending a lot of time looking at living learning communities, there's three journals on that that actually have some useful research in them. I didn't know that before.
Student Affairs has its own.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's journals on student development. There's
pretty much anything that can go well or badly has a journal.
Is there a journal on smart asses on the radio and podcast?
No, that always goes well, so you don't need to study it. So reading the other folks who are talking about it.
I haven't done that. And two, again, if there are people out there who think, you know what, I think I'll teach Shakespeare this semester. I've read some Shakespeare. I like Shakespeare. I'm going to teach Shakespeare. And, you know, okay, for undergraduates, if you applied yourself, you could probably put together an okay class. But
yeah, if I watch Slings and Arrows, I can talk for, you know, 15 class sessions about Shakespeare.
Yeah, so you see that.
But it would be bullshit.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. And so that's what I'm offering you today, you guys, when it comes to television.
That's exactly what we're looking for.
I'm offering a bunch of personal impressions. So even though I'm coming to it with an appreciation of, you know, Renaissance theater, shouldn't mean that I bring to our discussion any particular knowledge or value beyond the enthusiasm of somebody who really likes beautiful language.
So to land really hard for just a moment on what consilience is all about, is there a science version of this, Pete, that, you know, I can bullshit about this because I'm interested?
I'm afraid to say yes.
Cool. So, I mean, and this is the thing. Like, some people think that humanities is all what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. That it's just talk, because I read a book. But it's not.
It's not.
And then they think that science can't possibly be that. But Pete, those hopes.
Yeah, we are a little bit more constrained by interpretation is less important in the sciences. But let's face it, and people criticize the humanities for saying, well, it's all interpretation. But interpretation is the interesting part. That is the contribution. For me to hear a different interpretation that I never thought of before is what makes the humanities interesting. So you can't rely as much on interpretation, but the way we teach a course is we find a textbook with known fixed knowledge and we regurgitate that. So it's kind of, you know, you can't see it in a movie format usually. But I know guys that have taught courses on material science that were 3 pages ahead of the class in the book. And the truth is, that doesn't mean you can't do a good job doing that. So you learn the material, and then you help them discover how it works, why it's important, what the basic principles are that you can use, you know, in lots of different things other than just memorizing equations. But some people just say, here's equations, memorize this. Here, use this equation on problem number 2 for test number 1. And
which I have taken from the back of the book. That's not in your student version.
So I just did that, by the way. I just did that. I taught a course in the Middle East on foams. So I know a fair amount about polymer science, and I know a lot about basic chemical engineering and physics and chemistry.
We'll take your word on it.
But I spent an entire week, a lot of it was just before and during teaching the class, figuring out what stabilizes a foam. And it's a very complex amalgam of, you know, the strength of the polymers in the melt phase and the mechanical properties of the polymer and the dynamic response of the polymers. And we actually, you know, shared with the class some useful insights in how to make their foams for their polymers more stable or less stable or things like that. And it was not trivial. But it was all based on known knowledge. It was all in reference books, right? So we have a lot of stuff in reference books that we can use.
You weren't exploring foam.
Yeah, I actually did explore foam, but I didn't sleep for a week and a half trying to figure that out. That was my mistake. So I'd go in drinking Red Bulls. Like, okay, I found this great paper last night. Let's talk about this. But yeah, we can do the same thing. We can just regurgitate what's out there.
So how would you stop from just bullshitting about the connection of modern television, current television, and English theater?
Yeah, what would be required that would lead you to the scholarly paper?
Well, many things. One, I have to be conversant in what's already been written. So I'd have to figure out which the journals are. And there's a journal on pop culture, and mm-hmm. I'm sure there are television-specific journals that I'm unfamiliar with. So I'd have to go and read and see what the state of the discourse is.
And would you just find build a huge bibliography, maybe even come to one of my colleagues and get some help putting that together? And
what,
then
are you
just
plugging the library
all?
Now?
One does not have to plug the library. It's
the
like
library
crack.
Plugs
People
itself.
Want it.
wait, write that down. The library is like crack. People want it. I like that.
It's like Chris Rock says, you don't have to sell drugs. Drugs sell themselves.
Sells.
But would you just read all that? I mean, would you...
Yeah, I'd put aside some time. I'd do some reading. And then, and here's the difficult part, you would discover that there's some theoretical texts that are probably informing the discourse right now and some historical knowledge that I lack. And, you know, I'm basing my knowledge of television based on what I can remember of television in my lifetime. And, you know, that's pretty limited perspective.
Would you have to go back and read Understanding Media, or at least the television chapter of Understanding Media?
That wouldn't be a bad, you know, sort of starting point. But
oh, being a professor is so hard.
Is this an undergraduate textbook, I'm assuming?
No, McLuhan. I mean, he, you know, in the...
Is this McLuhan from Annie Hall?
Yeah,
yes.
That's
yeah,
the one.
That's the, okay, the one reference everybody knows.
No, I didn't even know that until about a month ago, and Charlie enlightened me.
In the late 50s and early 60s, and I forget when Understanding Media came out, but its effect was all there in that little nexus. You know, Understanding Media was this, it wasn't quite a textbook because I don't think you could really teach a course out of it.
But it was something, you know, it's interesting because I think it was crossover. So, you know, I think it had interest for scholars and for, you know, people.
You could
make a joke out of it on Annie Hall
and
people would know what you were talking about.
But that joke, the Annie Hall joke was in what, 74? I mean, it was like 15 years after. Anyway, there was a chapter for radio and a chapter for typewriters and a chapter for television and a chapter for The Telegraph and a chapter for a couple other things I can't remember because I didn't
study really.
Yeah, for sure. Wow. He was talking about what media did.
The Telegraph did change
or mediums
things.
Did to yeah. the content that was in them. Yeah.
But I will say this, that the way we approach trying to do scholarly work in the sciences is the same way. You've done some work in a field and you want to expand it into another field. You go read what's there in the literature, what other people have done. You hope there's a gap. You hope there's something that no one has done. And you say, well, they've done this, we've done this, our tool can help us explore this further, and that's what you pitch, and then you do that research and see if you learn something new. But I will say this, Charlie, it all starts with the library.
Sure does.
So it is like crack cocaine.
Can you postulate what the gap would be, Shannon?
No. I mean, I can't. I think that in some ways, I've had a few conversations with friends who do media studies. And one friend who was a Britain fellow who did specifically television. And it looked to me very much like the kind of thing I would do with a Shakespeare play. You know, I see something going on. She was working specifically in queer theory. And so, you know, it was depictions of homosexuality or implications of homosexuality where it didn't exist and sort of pointing it out across several shows and then theorizing it. And she was actually linking it then to also 9/11. So she had another sort of cultural layer that she
this
was
attaching
to.
This sounds vaguely like a joke about higher education from a distance.
You know what? I thought they were very interesting conversations. Yeah. She explained it very lucidly, and I thought, well, you know, I think the joke about higher education is that we're all just kind of talking to ourselves and, you know, not saying very much. I think that
Pete wants to jump in so bad.
Hey,
implications, but implications about homosexuality in
you're too
art,
far away from
medium,
me to punch you right in the head.
They're all over the place. I mean, you know, adult heterosexual men walk around on eggshells, think, "Oh, I hope nobody thinks I'm gay because I like romantic comedies." That is all over the place, and that affects society and commerce. I think that's very important. That's more than just a bunch of intellectuals talking. I'm amazed at the term queer theory. Is that really what they call it?
For sure.
As a comedian, I can use that at a gig Thursday night in Houston, Texas.
I
really
no,
don't
it's catchy, though. It's
a
lot of academics are now realizing. Well, we had this discussion, Shannon and I, yesterday with the folks from the QEP, the Quality Enhancement Program here at Georgia Tech.
Isn't it a Quality Enhancement Proposal?
Plan.
Okay, so we're both wrong. Thank you, Shane. And we're doing it on sustainability and service learning, and it's a really great idea. We got a presentation about it yesterday. But we acknowledge the cover of their proposal says, really catchy title here. We don't have a good brand for it. Queer theory, that gets you listening, as opposed to implications of homosexuality in society. Yeah, it doesn't do anything. But queer theory, you're going to listen up. Whether you are fascinated or you don't like the title, branding is important in academics now. Sorry to interrupt.
No, it's totally cool. So you were saying that the joke about higher education is that we're just talking to ourselves.
Yeah, the
you got to get on that mic.
What we're saying isn't socially relevant. Sorry, and you know
that what we're saying isn't socially relevant.
Well, maybe that we're mostly talking to each other, and that we speak a language that only other scholars can understand.
And do you think that's just the humanities, or do you think that is college in general? Like,
oh, that's college in general. That is not just the humanities.
But I want to hear what she thinks.
Yeah, well, I don't think it's true, first of all. I mean, I think that there is a discourse in which scholars are speaking to other scholars, and then their intended audience is other scholars. But I think that then trickles down into an undergraduate education in a way that does inform teaching, you know, so that what the students learn in the classroom is influenced by this discourse that's much more complicated that's going on at the professor level. I think that the fear is that the professors are just talking to each other and none of it matters in the end. And with the humanities, you know, you have to sadly make the case now that the humanities matter because people can't always perceive a relevance for literature and philosophy and history for their day-to-day existence. And that's just kind of an erosion of people's understanding of what education should be, and people are really shifting, I think, and I'm generalizing here, it's not everybody, but I think some people are really focusing on return on investment, right? So what kind of career is this going to get me? What sort of starting salary is it going to get me?
I can feel a headache forming just thinking about it.
I'm sorry. I know. The truth is that, you know, a knowledge of Shakespeare isn't going to inform your starting salary. It's not valuable in that way, but does it make you a fuller, richer, thoughtful person? I'm not saying people who haven't studied Shakespeare can't be those things, but I'm saying Shakespeare gives you a lot of fuel, a lot of
information. So if we had to oversimplify
to digest.
It, would it be Shakespeare comes in sort of at the end, not at the beginning? Like knowing Shakespeare will help you better when you hit 10, 15 years in the same profession and you're feeling like you don't know what you're going to do with your life and you're unsure about this whole parent thing and you're not completely happy with where you live in town and you need to figure out just who you are and where you're going and how to make yourself happy.
I had a professor once who said that nobody should read King Lear who's, you know, under 30 years old. There's no way to appreciate it. And, you know, I think that King Lear is valuable for anybody anytime they read it. You know, it's beauty, it's grace, it's big ideas. It's tragedy. It makes you confront mortality, and it's glorious. So I think that Shakespeare will benefit you whenever you encounter it with an open mind. But I think that you will encounter it and benefit from it differently as you get older. And so, you know, that professor certainly understood King Lear differently than I did in the moment when we were enjoying it together. But yes, yeah, so beauty, art, literature, these things are especially comforting, you know, when you are prone to despair. And that happens more and more as you age.
Is this where Deadwood comes in?
Because I never saw Deadwood. I'm just going to
throw it out there. Nice. Because
I feel like every season of Deadwood.
I can't watch everything.
That's true. He's watching Big Bang Theory. I feel like each season of Deadwood had a core fear of life at its center that became almost completely, you know, unconquerable, and then at the end it kind of fades out, and like that's what each of those 13 episode or 12 episode series were about.
A fear of life?
One of the general big fears of your life, like the loss of the potency as a person, as a potency as a man, as a potency as a mother, as a potency of a sexual woman, like, you know, all that. And I'm sort of thinking this is the first episode, like, I'm going to be the best whatever I can be, except I'm realizing that that's not worth it. I'm still going to get shot. And then how do we deal with the fact that even the greatest disappears? And then the second one was much more of a, you know, the relationships I have and the love that I have is not going to save me, you know, that the what I get is not going to save me, but only compassion and directed outward is going to save me. And the third one was that you can do everything as well or as right as you want, but outside forces will come and destroy me. And so these are not like, this is not the way to understand the story, but it just felt like those were these big existential fears that were being explored, and they were each brought to a boil and then dissipated in each of those three seasons.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a lovely expression of it too. Deadwood made use of the longer arc, and it's unfinished, and so.
And you think it always will be, right?
Yeah. Then they're not gonna.
So, Pete, there should have been four seasons, and if you go by the historical understanding of Deadwood, the fourth season should have ended with that first big fire that burnt Deadwood down. And since there is a line in the third season where I think it's Harry says, and two f***ing fire hats. I mean, they were getting ready.
Oh, even in the first season, there's somebody going around. Maybe it wasn't
first
season.
They're doing
kind of fire inspection. And, you know, they're saying you got
a damn stovepipe.
That's the one. So they're anticipating this inferno, you know, this resolution. But, no, they didn't get there.
Yeah. Which is kind of life, too, right? You know, a lot of best laid plans and just did not come through.
And I think that's actually the point of The Wire, which we can come back to later. I would say I haven't really thought about Deadwood in terms of the larger arc or those larger storylines or themes, because what struck me the most about Deadwood was the beauty of the dialogue. It was glorious, phenomenal.
You've heard some examples of the dialogue, have you not,
Beautiful
Pete?
Dialogue.
Senator, I decline the answer on the advice of my attorney.
I'll tell you what. I may have f***ed up my life worse than hammered shit, but I'll tell you this. I am beholden to no human sucker. Now, I didn't quite get it right.
Did they really mix?
I was convincing. I believed it.
Do they mix those two genres?
Totally. Oh, that is exactly how Deadwood works.
I mean, kind of like that Leonardo DiCaprio interpretation of Shakespeare in modern New York City.
Yeah, but that was actual Shakespearean language. And it wasn't New York City. It was in...
Where was it?
It was in a fictional place, but it was actually shot in Mexico City. Okay.
And they were wearing Hawaiian shirts.
Yeah. But that was Shakespeare's text.
But that sounds fascinating. I mean, we did have a discussion of the remake of, True Grit.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's kind of like California cuisine. I like California cuisine because they mix all the interesting bits of other cuisines. And to mix two styles of language would be very interesting to me.
Pete's like, well, if they say sucker, I might be interested.
this is what it was known for. I remember there was a New Yorker cartoon when Deadwood first came out.
Indeed.
It had all these words, in the cartoons.
A word cloud.
When they do the little punctuation instead of the curse word.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, exclamation point, number sign, at symbol, exclamation point.
So it had about 20 words formed out of those. And then it would say, all of these word punctuation sign words to indicate profanity, and at the end of it it said 17 miles to Deadwood, right? And so it was demonstrating that the language was really surprising. It was surprisingly profane, that it was over the top profane. And I think we've had a lot of examples of similar language in television since then, not all television that I've seen, but some of the British shows I think have a real...
Oh, is it In the Thick of It?
That's the one I'm thinking of.
The most recent Doctor Who got his first sort of big bout of fame by being a profane political fixer, I think.
Really?
That was In the Thick of It. Isn't that the name of...
That's not Doctor Who. Mean the actor who played...
Yeah, Peter
Capaldi. Okay, all right. Yes. That's what we're talking about. I was going to say, are they cussing on Doctor Who now?
The actual Doctor Who was a player.
So the message I'm getting here
is that the value of the humanities simply has a longer time horizon.
Ooh, interesting.
And I would say this, that... So you're preaching to the choir. I'm waiting for Charlie to finish. What was the thing about the value of a liberal education?
Beyond the University by Michael Roth. It's a good book.
I just think that students don't we throw this information at them and we fail to tell them why this will one day be important. And we do that with technical information. We're like, here's a lot of stuff. Well, what will we use it for? If you can't answer that question, you're not a very good instructor. And the value of the humanities is the fact that whether you are a scientist or engineer or a business person or a finance person, you are a human. You live amidst the other humans. You must understand the human condition. And sometimes it's an indirect benefit. It can only provide you with perspective that will keep you from falling into the pit of despair. Or sometimes it's a direct connection where it helps you understand people better. And that might help you one day indirectly via sales, commerce, science. I mean, to be honest, the idea of, you know, your imagination, the humanities, helping you with creativity is a very, very strong one. There have been studies on that one. I mean, I lecture on the value of that to technical innovation. So I believe in the liberal education. I think it's very important, no matter what your specialty might be. But why don't other people believe in that? Why are people just willing to say, what, a humanities elective? Not on my time.
I think people are too busy. I mean, I think that people, our lives are so full now, and that email and other portable phones have, mm-hmm. smartphones have allowed us to take so much of our time and apply it to industry and work that it's hard to have the opportunity to reflect. There was a time when, you know, the Industrial Revolution was supposed to bring on leisure, you know, and the opportunity to sit and reflect, yeah. and think and grow and develop as a thinking person. And I think that, you know, in our professional generation, we've seen it shifting into, you know, the, yeah. other extreme. So,
yeah.
that
the Industrial Revolution did bring on disposable income and leisure. It did.
But now we're just laboring all the time. I mean, what, yeah. it allows us to do is take our email with us and, you know, put in that extra hour or so from home. And, you know, so that we're still thinking about work. And I think everybody's thinking about work. And if you can't apply, you know, what you've learned.
But Facebook delivers unto me on a daily basis beauty and art and interesting things.
A lot of our art is being turned into escapism, too. Like the idea that, you know, get home from work and I'm just going to take an hour to watch some television and unwind, as opposed to, say, I'm now going to spend an hour watching television and sort of engaging it, right? That's not how it's sold. Even Deadwood, which was profane and intriguing and
violent
and sexy and also sort of historically interesting in its, mm-hmm. own special way. No one ever said that I could find, and I haven't done the research either, but I have spent a ton of time on the internet, right? no one ever said, you know, Deadwood, it raises your quality of life. You know, by engaging this work of art, you will in some way be enriched, which is how people suggest you deal with some other things that have, I guess, withstood the test of time and have become, instead of distractions, they have become fine arts.
Yeah, well, and I think that's the thing. I think we're really, really fortunate to live in a time when our leisure activity, our escapism, is itself elevating if you choose it wisely.
And would you doing a research project about Deadwood and Shakespeare, would that in some way be activism? And I mean, not literally activism, but would you be in some way saying, hey, here are the tools that you need to understand how Deadwood can elevate you, or would there be a different purpose?
Well, you know, that's happened. And there's a couple of philosophy professors out there who've done sort of the philosophical implications of a lot of popular culture, including Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and I think Deadwood. I might be wrong. But I think their television tastes align with mine a lot, so I really admire it. And I saw them at a conference, at a pop culture conference, doing the philosophy of Joss Whedon, the person who writes, mm-hmm. for Buffy the Vampire Slayer and Angel and others. And so that kind of exists. It's, yeah. not scholarship. It's crossover scholarship. And I think...
Why is it not scholarship?
Oh, it's not scholarship because it's designed for an audience who has less patience for footnotes, you know, who isn't interested in the deep background.
What's the definition of t-shirt? What's the definition of scholarship? More footnotes. I like that. That is a t-shirt.
Well, I mean, So that makes it sound like I'm
being... No, we're not making fun of you. I'm looking for clear, concise definitions of scholarship, and I think that's close.
Well, I mean, what makes you a scholar is the depth of your awareness of the field, and not everybody wants that level of rigor. You know, what they're interested in is, I think that there's something interesting going on about life and death in Battlestar Galactica. You know, how can I think more about that?
So sort of hey, isn't this cool?
Yeah.
Look, it's
yeah.
cooler than just TV.
The good scholars have a lecture prepared on both levels. So I introduced Scott Weems, who at the Decatur Book Festival, on his book, Ha, The Science of Why We Laugh, of When We Laugh and Why, or How We Laugh and Why. Okay.
That was probably a really shitty introduction.
No, my introduction was good, man. It was very good. But he gave the pop culture talk. With a lot of references to Mitch Hedberg, you know, it was just, hey, humor. And then he actually talked to our Humor Genome VIP project recently, and the student in my class, when she called him up to say, oh, could you do a Skype interview with us, I said, have him give the technical one on cognition and cognitive science. That's what we want to hear. Mm-hmm. And he has both. He told me he had both, and he did give the more technical one here. So maybe those folks do deliver a more scholarly thing with infinitely more footnotes to the scholarly community.
Oh, I'm sure they do. Yeah. I'm sure they do.
But Shannon is a scholarly community.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But obviously it was at a pop culture convention, so maybe they were.
Well, and that's not to say that people at the pop culture convention aren't presenting scholarly material. They are. But these guys have published books that you can get, you know, at Barnes & Noble and take home and read for fun. And whereas, you know, most scholarly books you have to order online. And, you know,
for $100.
And they cost a lot, or you get them from the library. And so it's a different kind of reading. I mean, it's work. Reading scholarship is work. It requires concentration and attention, and there's a very steep learning curve. It takes you maybe that curve isn't steep, but it takes you a while to get return on the time that you put into it.
Reading good scholarship is exhausting.
But you know, it wasn't always that way. In the first half of the 20th century, scholarship could be popular.
Yeah.
And the great thinkers of the time could be read by most anybody and valued and appreciated.
What changed?
Whitehead and C.P. Snow.
Okay, you're going to have to elaborate on that one.
There was and Shannon, you should correct me the moment that I tread into territory that I have no idea what I'm talking about. But there was a set of philosophers of education or philosophers of humanities education that kind of gave people permission to go deep and to go, you know, go to places that were not popular. They said this is important too. And in doing so, they kind of opened the door for people to get very esoteric and very odd. And then the bomb went off and you had postmodernism and then shit got crazy.
Also, tenure changed so that you had to publish. And, you know, as you got more and more, the GI Bill meant that there were more people going to colleges, there were more classes, there were more professors. And you had to come up with something new to say.
McLuhan's master's thesis or doctorate was on the pamphlets of a 16th century pamphleteer, a single guy. I think his name was Thomas Nash. That's what his dissertation was on.
So but I will claim. It's not going to have a lot of widespread effect.
I will claim this of the humanities as well, but certainly the scientific people. When we write a paper, I think we make it sound more complicated than it has to be. I think we sometimes do that on purpose so that people go, well, I don't understand a word they're saying, but it must be good.
You're trying to cover the fact that, well, our methods were this way because the grad student who set it up left and we didn't know what they had actually done.
Sometimes that happens. But I'm working on a popular book about science for normal people, and I want to write it. I've started writing it. So I meet Fridays with Catherine Meehan. We do some writing every week. And I want to do it in a first-person narrative the way Bossy Pants was written by
Tina Fey.
She has lots of footnotes. No, but I want to make it accessible to people. What this book, Is College Worth It, is making me think is that I should quit, start a series of trade schools, and put together a math course or two on math for the real world. Right, mathematicians are horrible too. I mean, they start with these arcane proofs and things like that. And pure mathematics is very, very important, but it's not important to the average person. But there is math that's important to people that cook and lay tile and do calculations of interest on your checkbook and things like that, that we don't teach well. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I agree. I think that I don't think that humanities scholars are necessarily trying to make things complicated to sound smarter than they are. I think that they all have a sort of baseline literacy when it comes to the things they're talking about. So they jump over that piece and go to the complication material that other people are going to need some time to catch up with. But I do think that means that we don't have then a lot of occasion for the baseline discussion, you know, for popular criticism that's informed and, you know, that goes beyond here's what you should see at the movies this week.
Or what describes baseline? This is awesome. I could talk for another hour, but we are running out of time. So what's the baseline discussion? And then you need to make your case for Deadwood, and then Pete's going to come up with something to end the podcast with.
So I would say that, you know, 10, 15 pages on why King Lear means something different to you when you're 40 than when you're 25.
I would like to read that.
And you can get away with that as scholarship?
No.
But man, that would sell like hotcakes.
I want to read that right now.
See, but that's what I'm saying. Where are you going to go to read that right now?
I'm going to go to television because the third season of Simpsons is about that.
So there you go. So, but that's happening through a creative mode. I think that it would be nice if there were popular criticism out there that was just a little more in depth, a little bit more informed, and demanded a little bit more of its readers.
Can you pull a model of criticism right now, like a person that, or a couple people, or even a school that you'd say that, you know, that's the good stuff. That's what we need to bring back, or what we need to have more of?
Well, you know, I would say that the writing in The New Yorker, there's a couple of magazines that are doing this already, right?
I want to say, I confused the two. There's Harper's, and then there's Harper's Bazaar. Harper's, I've read critical essays in that are just amazing. Harper's Bazaar is just like fashion, right?
Yeah, yes. Okay. Yes, you've now mastered that distinction.
Don't accidentally pick up the... Because I didn't quite get it at first. I'm like, you know, I read this great essay in
this Harper's. Harper's is bizarre.
And then I turn up this Harper's Bazaar. I'm like, this is nothing but short cocktail jerseys. What's going on?
Yeah. So Harper's, The Atlantic, you know, The New Yorker, and
so all of the media outlets that are slowly dying.
So
New York
print,
Times.
Yeah.
I want to say The Economist for us nerdy people. There's good stuff in these places.
You know, and I'm not sure Salon and Huffington Post is capturing it. I mean, it's harder to read things of great length online.
Yeah, even yeah.
And Huffington Post has nothing more than about four paragraphs.
They surround it with BuzzFeed style lists of.
Which is, it's a little irresistible. It's hard once you get there not to go, okay, I'm curious. I want to see what she looks like without makeup.
Yeah.
So, I'd like to see more of that. And it exists and it's out there, but it's not what professors are doing now. So there's that. And then I had three tasks. Push for Deadwood.
Tell us why Deadwood is worthy of some real serious scholarly critique.
So the beauty of the language. It's the beauty of the language. And it's surprising at first because, you know, your quote was very accurate earlier. There's a lot of C words and P words and F words and every kind of anatomical reference put together in a way that is so surprising and so graceful and so glorious. And often, you know, in conversation that's about a larger fundamental truth.
And I feel like that one without the other, it wouldn't, if you just took the story of Deadwood, it wouldn't be as amazing. It wouldn't drive you to, you wouldn't want to find everything out about it. And if it were just the language, it would be like, oh, this is like Aaron Sorkin and it's just terrible.
Okay.
Excuse me?
I like Aaron Sorkin.
I like Aaron Sorkin, too.
Here's what I mean when I say that, and we don't have to get off on an Aaron Sorkin thing.
We
but
can do that another time.
At a certain point, yeah, please. At a certain point, Aaron Sorkin's circular language actually covers up gaps in basic human compassion between his characters. And by his characters treating each other horribly, even though they're friends, is covered by this sort of ornate and fizzy language that's really fun to listen to. But sometimes you watch The West Wing and they are horrible to each other. And they're saying things that if a friend of mine said that to me, I'd be like, oh my God, they've never liked me and I don't want to be around them anymore.
I never liked you and I don't want to be around you anymore. That is just the nature of the flawed human condition. The realistic characters. Don't get me started on Newsroom or I'll come across this table and sock you.
I'm going to just make a footnote right here that Aaron Sorkin's the next time you come on, Shannon.
Oh, okay.
So with one without the other would not be anywhere near as rich.
I agree.
And is that Shakespeare too? Is that like Shakespeare's plots, which we can joke now that, oh yeah, Shakespeare's just full of cliches, but the plots were cliches in their own way, right? The plots were amalgams of previous stuff.
Yeah. So you didn't go for the story. You went for the expression, and the expression was phenomenal. And you know, some people say that, well, you know, he had sort of low comedy for the groundlings who were paying their single penny and giving up their beer for the day or whatever it was. But I don't think that's true. I think anybody exposed to that language is going to recognize that, well, you know, there's something special going on here. There's something beautiful. There's something elevating about being in the presence of this spoken word. And what was really lovely is that was shared with, you know, a couple thousand other people who were experiencing that exact same elevation in the exact same moment. And that collective experience is something that you lose with television and that you especially lose now in the age of Netflix, when you can just sit down and watch everything, you know, in a binge mm-hmm. experience and separated from everybody else who's watching everything. So I really miss the serial experience of television, which I just really don't get because I don't have cable. I mean, it's still serial for me, but it's not a shared experience.
Yeah,
where
the crew
I
of
can...
people on the couch watching and waiting to see and saying something along the lines of, that was bullshit. Is he dead or not?
Yeah, or you know, and I'm even thinking about, you know, the cliched water cooler conversation the next day where you're speculating what happened there, what's going to happen next. Yeah, I miss all that.
But, all right.
So the beauty of the language, I would say.
So when are you going to do this?
When am I going to do what?
When are you going to write your book about Deadwood?
In her copious free time.
I think about it sometimes, but yeah, it's hard. It's hard to find the time. I mean, it's back to that. We're working all the time now. We don't have the leisure to apply to the tasks that would enrich us in that particular way. Instead, we put it into the tasks. Then,
right, of coming in on a Saturday to talk to facet students.
I think what you both are saying is that the trouble is that we are beholden to human suckers.
Consilience with Pete and Charlie is a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
Recorded at the WREK studios on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta, Georgia.
Do the station or the campus support our views?
I'm guessing no. Would you?